Many people, especially young folks, are dreaming of their own small piece of land, self-supported, away from the stresses of the city, living a lifestyle of peace based on a deep relationship to nature and self. Today we are learning what it takes to make that dream a reality, the independent farmstead, living successfully off the land. That's our topic in this hour here on An Organic Conversation, your show on everything that makes life worth living. I am Helge Hellberg. Somewhere deep down in most of us, there's a desire to escape it all. Whether that's in the form of sailing around the world or, in this case today, in the form of buying a small farm and living more or less off the land, with only the least amount of necessary technology and amenities, but instead with a sky full of stars every night and a barn full of chickens. Is that still a reality for someone to create? The answer is yes, of course, absolutely. And today we get the complete picture of what it entails. The independent farmstead, living successfully off the land. That's a great new book written by a couple that really knows how to do it because they've done it. The independent farmstead, living successfully off the land. All that and more coming up in just a minute here on An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg. And this show is brought to you by Bowman College, a leader in the field of holistic nutrition and culinary arts. Become a nutrition consultant or a natural chef at one of their campuses, or learn from home in a self-paced mentored distance learning program. For more information on a degree in holistic nutrition or culinary arts, bowmancollege.org. And Fry Vineyards, America's first organic winery, family-owned and operated. Dedicated to the highest levels of organic and biodynamic farming, Fry never adds synthetic sulfites or other preservatives to their wines. Award-winning wines at frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com. And thank you also to Earl's Organic Produce, a national distributor of organic fruits and vegetables that has been sourcing solely organic produce for over 20 years. From grocery store to company cafeteria to caterers and personal chefs, anyone can buy from Earl's Organic. Certified organic produce at earlsorganic.com. And we're back here to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg. Our topic in this hour is how to make living off the land a reality. A brand new book that was written by two people who actually did it, who created that dream, the farmstead in this case, with a bunch of animals and some land to grow vegetables, to live in harmony with nature for most of their life, away from the city, with just the bare essentials in technology and amenities, but trading in for a life full of romance, a sky full of stars at night, and a barn full of chickens. The independent farmstead, living successfully off the land. That's our focus in this hour of An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg. And on the phone with me now are Sean and Beth Doherty, authors of The Independent Farmstead and also the owners of that wonderful piece of land that was their dream some years ago. onecowrevolution.wordpress.com is the farm's website. Sean and Beth, do I have you on the line?
Yes, we're here and very excited to speak to you.
Hi, Helga. Thanks for having us.
Of course. It's so great to really go down to the roots in that case, full pun intended. You made that dream that I spoke of in the introduction that so many actually of us have deep down. Somehow we all want to escape, and the picture of, you know, your own farmstead. How did that come up for you? Where were you at? What was your background in 1996? Just to describe your operation, 24 acres of some of the most worthless land, actually, in the upper Ohio Valley. What was the beginning of your journey?
We both grew up with fathers who raised beef cattle in Texas and Oklahoma. They were city men with city jobs, but they had grown up on farms. And like so many professional men there at that time, they bought hobby farms. And so we had the experience of building fence and rounding up cows and branding them. It was very much conventional operations, but that and maybe just our farming heritage made us both determined that the good life included living in the country and raising our own food. But the common wisdom when we were growing up, as it is now, is, you know, you really can't do that. I think what was meant when people said you can't farm anymore is you can't make a living at it. But the message was more like, well, you couldn't even begin. You can't afford the land. You don't know how to farm. You can't farm anymore. We're both stubborn, and we both have a tendency to think, well, if it's good, it ought to be possible, so we're going to try even though it looks like it's not. And that was what led to our buying a piece of land that looked nothing at all like a farm. At the time, we had the intention of just turning it over. We were going to buy it, fix it up, sell it in 2 years, and buy something that really was more like the image we had of a farm, you know, flat ground fences, a barn, a house. But in the course of working with this land, it taught us a lot about what's possible.
And one of the things that we really want to encourage young people who think, oh, I never can afford a farm, I never can do that, is to find any piece of land. One thing that we would say, it needs to have water. But other than that, almost any piece of land you can turn into a farm. And, you know, what you don't want to do is go into this massive debt finding this farm and then be underneath that. And we found a piece of property, this 24 acres, for $11,000. And it had a house on it, but it was trashed. And through sweat labor and sweat equity, we put it together and then gradually let the farm begin to inform us about how to farm, rather than coming to it with any vision of what this farm needs to be for us.
Well, since you're bringing up the finances, you started in 1996 when you bought those 24 acres, but the picture is, if anything, is even more bleak, and maybe it is not more bleak, but it seems more bleak today. The statistic, the average family farm income last year was a negative $1,400. So people are only able to support their family operations by working jobs offsite the farm.
I think one thing that escapes people's memories, because maybe simply because we don't study our history lessons well enough, is that until farming went completely out of style, starting in about the 1950s, farming was more often than not, and the farther you go back in history, the truer this is, more often than not, it was in some sense one of several occupations mm-hmm. of a man who farmed. Most people farmed. Most people did something else, too. So when we Americans today think, I want to be a farmer, therefore I'm not going to have any other income stream, we're really trying to invent a situation that didn't pertain back in the days when more people did farm. When we imagine that we're going to have an income stream that's generated solely by the farm, we're asking an awful lot of the farm.
And we didn't do that. I was an instructor. I was a professor at a university, which it's a really nice job and for a match for farming because my summers are more flexible. I've got longer vacations in there. But it was a steady income. But
it was a small income, though, and it was our only income.
And Beth, right, and Beth did not work. So Beth was our primary farmer in one sense. I was always, you know, involved with the farm, but Beth was the one who kept, and still is kind of the one who keeps it in her head better than I do in terms of the rotational grazing and all the things that we need to do. I think one of the problems that we see is the people who do want to try and make farming the source of all the income,
sure,
is that a lot of those people then don't even eat from their farm.
Most farmers don't raise their own food. That's statistically true.
Yeah,
so
that's
they bring things onto the farm and then they sell. And we are about providing for us, you know, our family. We have 8 children. So providing for our family, providing for our animals, instead of buying all of that in, we wanted the farm to provide that. And we've been very successful at being able to do that. And we just had some friends over yesterday, and we were talking about the food that we eat. You couldn't buy the food that we eat. It's all grass. We butcher our own, so it hangs for 2 weeks. It is fabulous food. You can't find it.
Yeah, Sean, you're making a great point. When we talk about farm income, it's what usually comes from selling the product. That was never the
correct
main objective, right? Even though
correct
maybe part
that's
of the overall model. But you are self-subsistent in that sense that 80% or 70% or 90% of your food, maybe 100, comes from your own land. And
right,
that is an income that is often not measured. It's a
right,
it's a passive income.
And what
income,
we're constantly trying to do is, so then what does the cash that I bring in mm-hmm pay for? It pays for the electricity, it pays for the things, and how can we continue to whittle away at those things mm-hmm so that I can now work part-time? And so recently I left my professor job and became a maintenance man for a convent up the road where we also farm. We started farming up there. It was able to cut down on our expenses, and so now I just flipped over. So now I'm kind of part-time maintenance man, part-time farmer for the convent. We also provide food for them. So I was able to spend now much more time on the farm, which is what I really wanted to do. And now how can I even cut that time back more? So constantly working at that process.
Great. You're listening to An Organic Conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg. The topic of this hour is the independent farmstead, living successfully off the land. And with me are Sean and Beth Doherty, the authors of The Independent Farmstead, a great new book, who are joining me today from Eastern Ohio. OneCowRevolution.wordpress.com is the farm's website. Let's talk about the beginnings of the farm. What did you start with after purchasing the land and this dilapidated building or house that it was on? What was the first important step? And what do you still think, looking back, that was the most important first step that you took? Or what is your advice to other people who are looking at a piece of land or dreaming of that?
Yeah, we're exploring right now either a second book or a series of articles. And in that, we have a week-by-week. Here's what you're going to do in your first week. Here's what you're going to do in your second week. Mm. And the first thing we say to you is buy a goat and some airline cable and a swivel hook and a concrete block. And you're going to turn that goat loose on your property that's dilapidated and run, you know, and because it was the only land that you were able to buy. And you're going to let that goat start to uncover what your land potential is.
We were blessed in having not a whole heck of a lot of income to solve our problems with. And one of the ways that works to a person's advantage is that we're in our ignorance, you know, of how farming is done and following an image of what we think farms ought to be like. If we have money, we have a tendency to sort of sail in and start slapping up fences and barns to create, in reality, the image that's in our brain. What really ought to be happening, and this is particularly true here in this country that is so full of little or bigger, neglected, wasted, trashed pieces of land, every one of which deserves to be reclaimed and regenerated, it's really important to that the land speak to you about what it needs to be doing. Sir Albert Howard was very clear in his, you know, sort of seminal organic writings when he said, the land needs to be your teacher. It needs to be the model that you're following to figure out how to farm. The country is dotted with little pieces of land, which, if they're not cheap, they're maybe available without being cheap. I can't tell you. We've been asked by people, please come on my land free of charge and take over my land and transform it mm-hmm. as you've transformed your land or the convent's land. Because there are lots of pieces of land sitting around nobody wants to deal with that have been neglected, have fallen into some form of dilapidation that just need a little slow, careful, attentive uncovering to begin to speak to the farmer and tell him what needs to happen to it. We were lucky, starting out with no money, that we just happened to think, look at these briars. We can't even get back onto this piece of property to see what's here. We've got to get a goat.
Can you explain that? What did the goat do? I get the cement block so she can't run away, I guess. But
right.
What does actually the goat do?
A goat eats all the thorniest, nastiest, most
thistle,
most intransigent pieces of plant life. Green briar and cane and thistle and multiflora rose. Those are all scourges here. They take over wasteland, and very quickly, nothing and nobody can get into the property short of, you know, burning in a machete or a bulldozer or, thanks be to God, a goat. So we started with one goat, and he was such a success at beginning to make holes in our impenetrable wilderness that he was quickly followed up by two does. And all of a sudden, we found we were on a small scale, we're already generating our own food because we were drinking milk coming straight from our land right from the beginning.
Yes, and then
you adjust, you know, as the goat does that, then grass starts to come in, and then you maybe get moved to sheep or, you know, maybe move to a cow, which was our next step was, you know, once we had enough, the goats had cleared enough for us, we wanted to move to a cow.
And of course, it does bring back your original message that there's no piece of land, however bad, and maybe there's some differentiation, but with the right amount of attention and care that cannot be turned into a beautiful little homestead. Can you describe what happened to your farm? What is it now? Can you put it in your own words 20 years later? Yeah,
well,
exactly. That's where I want you
to
go.
We hate to be sappy.
No, be sappy. This is the moment.
If we could bring you here and walk you over it, this time of year or in spring, it's really sort of Edenic, so I will try and not be too sappy in the description, but we're an east-west draw with very steep sides. The hills are wooded. Two small streams meet on our property and flow out the east end of our property. It was, at the time, utterly wasted. It was covered with trash. It had been neglected for a long time. It had been overgrazed. It had had the topsoil taken off as backfill for a county road. It had been logged, and the logging equipment had been parked and compacted the soil, what was left of the soil down in the valley. It was in really dreadful shape. It was mostly rocks, shale, and clay, and weeds and briars. Today, that same valley, even the steeper parts of it, are beautiful green grass. You can't find soil anywhere because it's so thickly covered. The margins of the creek are grass right down into the water because careful flash grazing has broken down the steep banks where it would erode and allowed grass to germinate and cover that soil. We've built over time some small barns, put in small amounts of permanent fence where it was going to be the most valuable. And we grow most of our food here, milk, beef, lamb, pork, poultry, and big gardens year-round.
Another really important step is once the goats have begun to reveal what the land has, then getting a larger herbivore in that will eat the grass, graze it, and then keep them moving. You know, a real problem would be to just turn your cow loose on the land, which is the problem that we did at the beginning. You know, we did conventional grazing. And then we heard about this intensive rotational grazing where you're keeping an animal in a very small area. You know, a single dairy cow in the size of something like two bedrooms. That's about as big as it needs to be for 12 hours. And then you move it 12 hours, and then you move it 12 hours. You keep it moving, And you give that grass then a rest of 60 days, 90 days. You don't let anything back on that grass. And that's the transformation that we, people kept saying, you will not believe it. And that's absolutely right. In 3 years, you cannot believe that this is the same place.
Well, it's mimicking bison, right? Biomimicry,
large
herds of bisons moving in kind of slow, super slow speed, but ongoingly, 150,000 animals. And then just like cut hair, the grass grows back so much quicker.
Right.
That's what you're doing on a smaller scale and
on the tiny scale. And that's what we're so excited
about.
You know, Joel Salatin and all those people who are doing it on the bigger scale, it's fascinating and exciting. But can it happen on the small scale?
With one cow.
And that's what we were interested in, and it's working.
Beautiful. We want to talk about the mistakes that were surely made and what are the steps after the goat, self-sufficiency, and a few other questions that we have. We'll take a quick break, but please stay on the line. I'm speaking with Sean and Beth Doherty, the authors of The Independent Farmstead, who are joining me today from their farm in Eastern Ohio. OneCowRevolution.wordpress.com is the farm's website. In this hour of an organic conversation, The Independent Farmstead, living successfully off the land. Finally, someone who can tell you how to do it and what the steps are and which mistakes are there to be avoided, perhaps. Sean and Beth, stay on the line. We'll take a quick break, but we'll be right back with more. And a thank you to our underwriters, Equal Exchange, a worker-owned cooperative that ensures your food is environmentally sound and socially just. Equal Exchange has been creating big change for small farmers for over 30 years by offering certified organic and fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate, bananas, and avocados. More on Equal Exchange at equalexchange.coop. That's equalexchange.coop. And by Udderly, offering beautiful and fun clothing for boys and girls that is made entirely from the unused fabric of prominent apparel manufacturers. Each garment reduces our eco footprint by preventing this fabric from reaching the waste stream. Udderly, making sustainability fashionable and fashion sustainable. For more information, udderly.co. That's UTTERLY.co. And we're back here to an organic conversation. Our focus in this hour is The Independent Farmstead, how to make that dream of living off the land a reality, living successfully off the land. And we couldn't be speaking with the couple that made it possible, better guests, Sean and Beth Doherty, the authors of The Independent Farmstead, who transformed 24 acres into a oasis of the Upper Ohio Valley in 1996 to now. Let's talk about self-sufficiency one more time. Did you know that you mostly wanted to produce your own food, or are you now actually able to also sell a portion of it? What's that mix for you?
Yeah, we did start out with the intention of raising as much of our food as we can. One of the snags that people run into, we certainly did, when they start out trying to raise their own food is that there's often a catch-22 in the instructions that you'll run into in a how-to book, how to raise chickens, you know, how to keep a garden, how to keep a dairy animal, and that most of those instructions are simply the conventional methods scaled down, the conventional industrial methods scaled down for home use. what that comes to in a nutshell is that an awful lot of the instructions for being self-sufficient and raising your own food start by sending you to the feed store to buy the animal's food, which is how we started out. And we had a sort of nagging sense as we unloaded sacks and sacks of grain from the car that there was something wrong with our neat little self-sufficiency experiment. It was great food, and we were very pleased with ourselves for sort of figuring out how to keep chickens and how to keep goats and a dairy cow. But it was when we ran into Joel Salatin's book, Salad Bar Beef, and then other explanations of intensive rotational grazing, that we realized real farming starts with sunlight and rainfall and the soil and doesn't have to go off the land to bring in most of its nutrients. The land, when it's managed that way, a small piece of land is more than capable of producing more food than the people and the animals living on it need. And then, yes, it does get exported. But as you pointed out, Helga, earlier in the conversation, people often fail as they drop their balance sheet on the farm. People often fail to take into consideration all the non-cash benefits that go with farming. This farm is 90% of our food, 90% of our animals' food. It's 99% of our entertainment and our culture and our family values and our time together. So it obviously produces a lot of non-cash value.
Yeah.
We're happy to say it does produce some cash value. We've run a Ohio law prohibits the sale of raw milk, but people can buy a share in a cow or in a herd.
Membership based. Yeah.
That's right. And that it's actually contractual purchase of a share in a herd, and that generates not a small amount of income. It's a lot of work, but again, that work is generating many other benefits besides the cash.
It sounds like it's really a almost biodynamic way of looking at your land, where all the inputs should come from the farm itself, right? Seeing the
farm as
one organism. Is that your philosophy, basically?
Yes, and we would have something that we would be purchasing frequently or over and over and over again, and our question became, how can we then provide that instead of making that a purchase from off farm?
Beautiful. What do you do in winter? There's always, I mean, especially Ohio, many other areas, California is pretty much blessed with a year-round production of some sort, but even now with the rain, the soil is too heavy to bring equipment in. So what do you do in your area in winter? Does the production continue? Of course, with livestock, it does.
Right.
But with vegetables, how do you supply for yourself throughout winter?
Well, presently in the garden, there's a 35-foot, about 12-foot-wide high tunnel, which is an unheated plastic greenhouse, over three beds of produce, and that will generate our salad greens and carrots for the whole winter and well into the spring, until we're already eating from the spring and summer crops. Those winter vegetables will carry us. And the root cellars are full of food. Milking is a year, we're presently milking three milk cows, so that's a year-round chore. And with dairy products, what you're eating is yesterday's sunlight converted into today's high-quality milk, cheese, butter. So those chores are forever.
And there are always the winter projects. So this year has been exciting. You know, we've had the winter project of a barn or a larger barn or something like that. Again, trying to mill the wood from our property. We have a sawmill and we do that. But this year, the land below us, there was about 3 acres with a very dilapidated house, even worse than our original house. And we have purchased that for a very minimal amount of money. And we're redoing that house with the hope that what we would love is for people to come visit and to see what we do. And we want to be able to provide housing for them. So we're working on that.
So winter, you're saying finally the season to get some things done, yeah?
Yes, that's right.
Can you walk us through the rest of the year? Like, I mean, there's the classic vegetable seeding in spring, early harvest, summer. But is that different to any other farm when you do it for yourself? How do you...
One of the biggest differences is that we're trying to get away from hay, which is the big winter job. Well, it's a big all year round. You know, if you're putting up hay and doing all that all summer long, along with the other jobs, and then winter you're putting out the hay for the animals. Well, we do a thing called stockpile forage, which you know, again, Joel and all of those people in that world are using now, so that you've got areas of land that you keep the animals off of for a certain amount of time. Then in the winter, you let them in on that. And despite the fact that it's frozen and despite the fact that it even has snow on it, the cows will get underneath there and they will eat that. So we are trying to minimize the amount of time that we actually give hay. So we're in our stockpile forage right now. So it's a lot of, again, intensive rotational grazing through that. So that, in some sense, stays kind of the same with the summer.
Another difference, a thing that makes the small independent farmstead different from, say, the kind of schedule you'd see on a more conventional farm, is that the independent farmstead is always going to be a fairly diverse mix of species, both plant and animal. As Wendell Berry points out, it doesn't matter whether we like it or not, good farming is always going to have to involve animals. And not only one kind of animal, as you would normally find on a conventional farm, all pigs, all chickens, all dairy, or all beef. Good farming requires that you have a multiplicity of species so that you get a lot of feedback between species. That means that chores, you have a lot more of them, but of course they're all filling smaller niches on the farm. It keeps life full of variety. You're right, we have some really busy seasons, so I think our feet hit the ground running about the beginning of April. We've already got lots of plants in the greenhouse that we're getting ready for the garden, but that's all been sort of quiet labor. Once April comes, we're moving fast, moving cows, building fence, putting in gardens. Summer is, I don't know, right about now we're starting to think, okay, we're just about finished getting everything in and we can settle down into a winter pattern that does include some of the non-animal, non-gardening chores that get put off the rest of the year.
Sure.
Working on our new cabin and so forth.
It sounds amazing, and it sounds, I know you don't own a TV, so 99% of the entertainment is the farm and then 1% each other perhaps, but how have you not gone on a vacation? Do you miss that? Let's talk about, know what is beautiful, and we want to get to that a little bit later, your message to young people and your encouragement to do this, but what's the hardship in this? What has been difficult?
We're a little unconventional in a lot of ways. One of the ways we're unconventional is we have 8 children. When you have 8 children spread over 21 years, there's generally somebody around who has a reason for being home and can handle things while part of the family goes somewhere. So people will take a weekend and go out to the lake. Sean and I travel a bit to speak or teach, and the kids manage the farm just fine while we're gone. What are the hardships, Sean? Getting up at 2 o'clock in the morning to chase a calf that's gotten out, that's a hardship. Standing in the rain, giving IV calcium to a cow that's calved and is having milk fever, calcium deficiency. Those are hardships, but honestly, I don't think we look at them that way. There's something about going out and doing your chores in the rain and coming in soaked that fills a visceral need that I think people are often trying to fill by watching exciting programs on TV or going bungee jumping or something. We don't feel that impulse. We get plenty of excitement just in our ordinary day.
Sean, do you want to add to that?
I think that birth of new animals on the farm is really exciting for all of us. Yeah.
We have a lot of parties built around farming.
Yeah, that's
right. The year is dotted with occasions where people come together, our own family, but families around us, to butcher animals. For example, we have a 3-day shindig in the winter where 3 families plus a lot of other people who just enjoy the fun of it get together and butcher 4 hogs. We butcher other times of the year, and that's always fun because it brings a lot of people together for work that's going to taste good afterward. We hosted a farm-to-table as a benefit for the Franciscan monastery up the road. That was a lot of fun. Our entertainment sort of built in.
We are speaking with Sean and Beth Doherty, the authors of The Independent Farmstead, in this hour of an organic conversation. I'm Helge Hellberg, and we're talking about living successfully off the land. Sean's and Beth's website is onecowrevolution.wordpress.com. It sounds incredible, and it is visceral even by listening to you. The meaning of life, the directness of life in your life, around you, through your hands, is tangible, is clear. And we are almost out of time already, but I do want to ask you both, if somebody listens to this, and we're listened to in 135 countries, it doesn't even need to be here in the U.S., what's your biggest message for anyone, and particularly young people, toying around with the idea of a farmstead?
I think one of our biggest messages is do it. Jump in. Don't hesitate. I think people should do this with marriage, too, in a certain sort of way, is just be reckless or reckless abandonment. You know, don't hesitate. Let the land teach you. Know that there's going to be mistakes. We are always making missteps, so that we planted our potatoes this year. We tried it with a different method of trying to mulch really heavily and not rototilling on either side of it. It ended up being a mistake. We didn't weed in time. You've got to know that that's going to happen, and then you've got to not get discouraged about it. So just jump in. Know that you're going to make lots of mistakes, but the best teaching is by doing, rather than studying it for too long or thinking about it for too much. Just buy those chickens, start to do it, and it will inform you.
One thing that's really important to us is to emphasize to people that every piece of land deserves to be regenerated, and every willing person has the potential, if you have the use of more or less your arms and legs, has the potential to become the farmer that makes that land happen. And it's going to happen when you partner with animals to take the land where it wants to go anyway. Intensive rotational grazing is almost always going to be an integral part of any self-sufficient homestead.
Great. I don't know if you just realized how much you spoke of the classic archetypal gender role of, Sean, you were really all about doing and make the mistakes and allowing that and reckless abandon. And Beth, you spoke of the creation and of the care and the nourishment. And maybe that is the greatest lesson from the land to bring us back to who we are and our truest self in that.
Oh, I think that's beautiful, but I would absolutely agree with that.
Helga, I thank you for that. That was lovely, and I didn't think of it.
There are things that we have, in a certain sense, decided that those can't be real. And I do think when we go back and let it inform us, that we stumble upon things that, real truths.
That's a mouthful. When you surrender yourself to this, the payback in truth and beauty is incalculable, and it's very insidious. It creeps under your skin, and you suddenly realize, I'm living something that I didn't believe could happen.
Wonderful. Perfect final words. I wish you the best of luck with your incredible book. Again, that's The Independent Farmstead. Are you going on book tour? Not really.
Well, because of the farm. We are. We do a lot with the Mother Earth News conferences.
Great.
And then we're going up into New York and to Massachusetts to do a couple of
NOFA conferences,
yeah.
Wonderful. onecowrevolution.wordpress.com, your website. You said you might add some ongoing articles to it. Lots to learn there anyway.
Yeah.
Is that right?
There are lots of posts there as we learn things.
Yeah, great. Thank you so much for making the time, and maybe I will make it out there one day.
We would love it.
We would love to have you. There's a plate and knife and fork at our table for you anytime, Helga.
Thank you. That's Sean and Beth Doherty, again, the authors of The Independent Farmstead, who made it a reality, living successfully off the land with that much grace and dignity and beauty. Thanks for making the time again. Pleasure to have
Thank you.
Thank you
for your interest.
Take care.
Okay.
Speak
Bye.
Soon. Bye-bye. It's so interesting to me every time how tangible beauty becomes when you touch it, when it's present. Again, Sean and Beth Doherty, The Independent Farmstead, authors of that amazing book, which might help you to answer that call deep down to escape it all and follow your dream of buying a small farm and living more or less off the land with only the least amount of necessary technology and amenities, but with a sky full of stars and a heart full of love and a barn full of chickens. We're staying with the topic of sustainable agriculture and moving into produce, fruits and vegetables. Here's the consumer segment, the update from the world of healthy fruits and vegetables, what to do with them, how to buy them, how to store them. The update from the San Francisco produce dock. Here's what's in season. And with me, as every week, is Earl Herrick, the voice of the San Francisco produce market, with an update of what's going on, how to pick it, how to store it, and what to do with it. Earl, do we have you on the line?
Hello, Helga.
Hello.
Here we are.
Cha.
Yes.
You're back. What are you excited about?
We're seeing, you know, the increase in appreciation of certain aspects. Fair trade is one. Where that now we've seen it stabilize in the chocolate and the coffee areas. We're now seeing another push, and we're very big on this personally with our company, is in the fair trade, identifying what that is and getting more and more people to understand the real benefits that are going on the grower level. The fair trade allows that money to go back to the individual people that are working out in the field, and collectively that group of laborers get to choose how that money that is being collected as the fair trade premium, how that money gets to be used. So that is just going to get more and more specific, more and more well documented, and we're going to continue to push that to educate people about that.
Do you feel that people are the people who buy your produce, not who produce it, but that the education is keeping up with that? Like, does the general public know about fair trade at this point from your perspective?
Well, I think it probably is still strongest on the coast, and that's generally true. And so I think it will grow from that. So I think the short answer is yes, but we're really just touching the tip of the iceberg, as we're putting the onus, and I think rightfully so, on the grower and on that, those boards, those fair trade boards, to do a better job of collecting that information, making it concise, and getting it out to us so we can put that forward. We had we've had some seminars up here with some growers that are now entrenched in fair trade.
Yeah, we're going to do a show on one of your growers, actually a pretty large operation, right, with 600 farm workers. They all went fair trade, that operation. What's the name of the operation again?
The name of the parent company is Circle, and the organic portion of it is Covilli.
Oh, Covilli
and
Farms,
the husband
that's right.
And wife that are really behind it, and we've been doing business with these folks for over 15 years, and we feel they're the best grower in Mexico for us. They do a fantastic job, and they grow with summer vegetables, so think zucchini, bell peppers, beans, cucumbers, and tomatoes. You know, they do a phenomenal job.
Yeah, and I think most people, when they hear fair trade, if they know about what it roughly is, they think it's a co-op of 30, you know, coffee growers, whatever product it may be. In this case, it's one farm that decided that for their 600 farm workers to go fair trade, which means they're producing hundreds of thousands of dollars back to that farming, picking community, that they get to decide what to do with the money.
Yeah.
We will do a whole show on that. It was just a fascinating conversation that I was able to have with them a few weeks back.
Yeah, it is fascinating. A couple other things to wrap this up. We were able to source more heirloom apples from the Northwest out of Oregon. And heirloom apples are apples that generally are not grown in large supply.
Uh-huh.
They're apples that have either been forgotten or not as popular, but they're wonderful apples, so we're continuing to expand that. We're getting some coconuts from Costa Rica now, as coconuts start to have their 15 minutes of fame that perhaps will get more traction. We're now also seeing what people have been talking about for the last 5 years or so, is the development of a year-round crop of blueberries in California. Part of that is due to One, understanding that there are many pockets within the diverse climates of California where they can be grown, and also the development of varieties that can withstand a little cooler temperatures.
Cool.
So we're right on the threshold of having 12 months out of year of blueberries that are high quality, and thus that'll bring the price down.
Exciting.
Make it local. It's really a great development. And last, we deal with this Satsuma grower up in north of Sacramento, and in doing business with him for the last 20 years, his neighbors have been growing. He's in the middle of a huge area of Satsuma orchards, and and there are several of his neighbors that are now going organic, seeing how well he's doing and how what a great job that he's doing. And that's just another aspect of how this industry grows, how people see how success breeds success, and just our ability.
Innovation.
And really, it's about his ability to continue to put out a product that is so superb and to be able to do so well economically. So,
well, it's your ability to distribute it and to educate about it. It's our ability to amplify the message. It comes down to education and the consumer really embracing all the efforts that go into it and understanding it of what you get when you buy that organic piece of produce.
That is so true.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
Cool. Exciting. Right. Exciting year to come. We look forward to many upcoming segments.
Helga, great talking with you every week. I look forward to doing this every week.
Okay. Take good care. Thanks, Earl.
All right.
Bye.
Bye now.
And that is Earl Herrick, the voice of the San Francisco produce dog, Mr. Organic. Check out earlsorganic.com for produce updates, what's in season, how to buy it, how to choose it, what is the best item, and what to do with it for that week when it comes to organic fruits and vegetables. He's the man. And that wraps up an hour focused on farming, what's in season, and how to live successfully off the land, how to make the dream of an independent farmstead or interdependent farmstead a reality for you. Beautiful hour, and hopefully inspiring to some of our listeners to follow that dream, buying a piece of land and making that farmstead a reality for themselves. It's possible, it's doable, and The Independent Farmstead is the book that can guide you in it. OneCowRevolution.wordpress.com. Again, the website for Sean and Beth Doherty. I'm Helge Hellberg. This is An Organic Conversation, and I look forward to being back with another episode next week. Take good care. And that was this week's edition of An Organic Conversation. Thank you so much for listening. A big thank you also to our associate producer, Kristen Ponger. An Organic Conversation is made possible through listeners like you and the fantastic support of our underwriters. Equal Exchange, a worker-owned cooperative that ensures your food is environmentally sound and socially just. Equal Exchange has been creating big change for small farmers for over 30 years by offering certified organic and fair trade coffee, tea, chocolate, bananas, and avocados. More on Equal Exchange at equalexchange.coop. And Utterly, offering beautiful and fun clothing for boys and girls that is made entirely from the unused fabric of prominent apparel manufacturers. Every garment reduces our eco footprint by preventing this fabric from reaching the waste stream. Utterly, making sustainability fashionable and fashion sustainable. For more information, utterly.co. Also, Earl's Organic Produce, a national distributor providing certified organic fruits and vegetables for your store, home, or business. Are you a chef? Have a catering business, or planning a party, or simply just love organic produce? Anyone can buy directly from Earl's Organic at wholesale prices. The website is earlsorganic.com. And Fry Vineyards, America's first certified organic winery, producing organic and certified biodynamic wine without synthetic sulfites or other preservatives. Family owned and operated since 1980. Fry Vineyards, Mendocino County award-winning wines. For more information, frywine.com. That's FREYWINE.com. Lastly, thank you as well to Bowman College, focused on holistic nutrition and culinary arts for over 20 years. Bowman College offers professional training programs that prepare individuals for careers as nutrition consultants and natural chefs. Their website is bowmancollege.org. That's B-A-U-M-A-N college.org. If you missed parts of this show or for any other episode, go to anorganicconversation.com or subscribe to our show on iTunes, Stitcher, or Google Play, so you'll never miss an episode. And for more information, health tips, recipes, and your daily dose of inspiration, find us on Facebook and Instagram at An Organic Conversation and on Twitter at Talk Organic. I'm Helge Hellberg, and we'll be back with another great episode right here, same place, same time, next week. See you then.